Hello and welcome to Property Money Tree's Maximising Property Values, the once a month show where I break down the steps of how to recognise, enhance and then extract the values in property in order to create wealth. Would you like to find out how you can benefit from the steps of maximising property values? This is even if you don't own a property yet or have a deposit. If that's a yes, then you're in the right place to find out. My name is Patricia Ogunfaber, and although many know me for my work as a solicitor, on this show you will be getting the benefit of my 30 plus years worth of experience of maximising property values, experience which has given me a net worth in millions. So who might benefit from listening to this show? Literally anyone with an interest in creating property wealth.
And we are back for another episode of the PBK podcast. Now, I've got a fellow podcaster, fellow property developer, and also someone that, ironically, I'm going to have to just introduce as Auntie P, because culturally, you know, I have to maintain our level of cultural respect. So, Auntie P, please introduce yourself.
Oh, thank you, Kaz. So I'm, as you know, Patricia Ogunfaber. Was a solicitor for many decades. Mm-hmm. And then in 2015, I decided that I just wanted to just do my property stuff full time. So gave up, well, retired from the law and then came back into property and started doing all the exciting things that just put a smile on my face regarding property, which I'd been doing really since 1986. So I first became a landlord in 1986. But then when I was kind of like, you know, practicing law, I was using estate agents to do stuff for me and, you know, working with builders. And it was very frustrating. But since I've been doing it myself, so much better.
Nice. And then obviously, so outside of that, you have also written a best-selling book on Amazon, Be Prepared, Renter's Right Bill, that we're going to take a deep dive on, because a lot of you are not prepared for what's coming when we talk about all things around the renter's rights and what's changing. Mm-hmm. And you also have a brand new webinar, Tenant to Owner, talking about the journey taking people from being tenants to owning their own properties. There's loads of exciting things that we're going to unpack in today's conversation.
Yeah.
But I want to start with the transition, because I speak to a lot of people, right? And they might be working in the city, they might be working for the NHS, they might be in finance, in wealth management. And a lot of them, like you did, almost 40 years ago, 39 years ago, dabbled in property, really saw and reaped some of the rewards, but didn't do it full time and maybe wished they did it full time a little bit earlier. What actually inspired you to make the transition from law into full time property?
Okay, so I didn't actually have any regrets about when I moved into property full time. I loved the law. I left the law because there was a bit too much red tape. And I moved into property and now there's even more red tape in property. But in terms of moving over, it was just one of those things. I've always kind of like, I suppose I've got an artistic thing in my body. I paint artwork.
Not the walls there. No, we can't get you round for a quote for a two bed flat.
Do you know, I used to actually paint walls, and then I'd paint a flat or somewhere for maybe a week, and then I'd be in bed for another week. Yeah. And then I realised that
people
I couldn't
underestimate
do it.
How like tiring
yep.
that one is.
Yep. But no, so now I just do like canvases and I do like my own artwork and stuff. So I have that thing, and I love just looking at a really, really ugly property and just walking around it and just seeing this picture in my head as to what I can turn it into. And it was more that than anything that kind of like made me want to do it full time. And then when I wasn't doing it full time, people were ripping me off. And in fact, there's a very good friend of mine who used to say, there was one particular builder that I had. He said, oh, you are his DSS. Because in the day, like if you claimed benefits, you claimed it from the DSS. And so he would just turn up and say to me, Patricia, I need payment at the end of the week and hardly do anything at all. So, you know, been there, done that. But now that I'm sort of like, hands on, I make sure that the corners, corners that shouldn't be cut are not being cut. So, and you'll be aware as well, if you're doing things that need sound insulation, it needs to be done in a particular way.
Sure.
Because otherwise you can do it. You can spend a lot of money and then have it tested and fail. And that's even going to cost you even more money. So I'm there literally every day just making sure it's done properly. And I get on the builder's nerves. And they often say to me, please don't come. Don't come tomorrow. Don't come tomorrow.
Yeah, builders don't like the idea of you walking around on site. I kind of get it, because when I'm doing stuff, when you're doing stuff and someone's watching you, it's like,
yeah,
all right. So I think, but from that, I guess it's more from a passion perspective.
Yeah,
that,
I love it.
You'd loved it, Love the idea of the transformation, the artistic side of the project. But coming from a legal background, how do you think your background in law has shaped the way you look at property deals and opportunities?
I guess in a way, in terms of like looking at opportunities, I'm a bit more critical. I really look into things and I look into the legal fundamentals, even though I'm not qualified as a property lawyer, but at least I have an idea. And then if I think it's all good, and then I pass it on to a property lawyer who actually does that for a living. So in that respect, it's really helped me. So again, buying in auctions, I can have a look at the special conditions. I can have a look at the legal pack. I can see whether or not it seems to kind of like be okay. And if it is, then I pass it on.
But you still though, even with your background, you would still always pass
it on. Oh, I would always pass it on, because that is why you have experts in certain areas, because they know, all the ins and outs of things. So I might have a broad idea and a broad view, but I would never do it myself.
Just as a general reminder, bearing in mind, we have a fully qualified solicitor that's saying they wouldn't do their own legal pack reviews. ChatGPT is not a lawyer, because we've had some people recently that have purchased the auction off the strength of putting the legal pack in ChatGPT. So
it's that is just being penny wise and pound foolish. Because, you don't want to spend, how much? Maybe £2,000. Okay, for a legal pack, maybe £500 to actually review it. And then it's going to cost you, thousands to unravel the mess.
Yeah, because say, for example, it's a property that's being back-to-backed, your lender won't lend on it.
Yeah.
Now, all of a sudden, your purchase price is 400K. That means you've got a 40K deposit that you could potentially lose because you haven't done the due diligence.
Yeah. I know it doesn't cease to amaze me, how people think or where they think they can actually save money. And all they're doing really is actually costing themselves even more.
And I think it's something that resonates throughout the development process. You have to really work out actually where you make money from spending money versus actually where sometimes, you've overspent and it's just a vanity project. But I think understanding where spending is good versus bad is probably one of the cornerstones of being a good property investor.
Do you know, I completely agree with you. But even on the vanity side of things, I guess it depends on your standards. So I can't do a project, no matter how over budget it might be. I still have to have my professional silicon person come in and
do... The mastic man.
And every single builder I've worked with will say, oh, no, we can do that for you, Patricia. And I just say, no, don't worry, I'm not. And they come in and how much does it cost? It doesn't cost very much.
Flat, £200.
£270, exactly, and a bathroom. And it just makes such a big difference.
My guy, Clive, wizard. By the way, have you ever tried to do silicone?
I have.
Nightmare. Had to throw away the bath mat. Had to all my hands covered in silicone, trying to get it off. I'm going down, washing up liquid, soap, everything. Listen, just sometimes, trust the professionals.
Yeah. Do you know, even I've got a tenant who's just moved out and I've gone and had a look at his shower, because at some point I decided that even for my HMOs, I wanted walk-in showers for my tenants. So when they
you learn your lesson,
when they move, but it's still okay so far. But so this guy's moved out, and I've looked around, and some of the silicon is actually coming away. And I'm thinking, shall I just get a silicon gun and just do it myself?
And the answer, by the way, is no.
I know. And I immediately said to myself, no, I'm going to get the proper person to come in. They'll cut it all out. They'll put it in again, and yeah, we'll be golden.
And I think people that pay attention to detail a lot of the time, like I look at some of the members from the PBK, and when I go around to the projects that are finished and are done really well, it's those little things, again, that 200 to 300 pounds are spent.
It just
the
elevates.
Difference between there not being that little gap where the skirting meets the flooring, you know, all of the silicone being, you know, in line and uniform in the bathrooms.
Yeah.
And it's... At the end of a project, no one wants to spend an extra £200. £200 feels like 2,000.
Yeah.
At the beginning of a project, £200 feels like £2.
But
it's understanding where and how to add value.
Yeah.
And it's those visible things at the end that your end user is going to come and see those little bits of detail and be like, this is somebody who actually cared. So the likelihood is everything that I can't see is also going to look good as well.
Precisely. Yeah.
So in terms of your ethos, I see it online, I see it throughout the podcast, I see it on Clubhouse. It's about maximizing value in property. What does that mean to you?
So what it means is what is worth doing at all is worth doing well. And so this property side of what I'm doing is actually my business. It's where I get my money from. It's what pays me to do what I'm doing. So I take the view that if I'm going to do it at all, I might as well just do it well and then be paid for what I'm doing. So I'm not asking for people to pay me for something that I don't deserve. Mm-hmm. I think I'm offering a premium product and do expect to be paid for it. But it's not just the money side of things. It's also actually making the best of what you have. So I could maybe, walk into a place. It might be a studio flat. In fact, I'll give an example of a studio flat that I bought once. So it was a studio flat in W2 in London. And it was on the market for, I think it was £340,000, which sounds like a lot of money for a studio flat. And it was a complete wreck. But I saw the potential in it. And a few of us were interested in it. So I offered an extra £10,000 over and above the asking price. And I paid £350 for it. I then converted it into a one-bedroom flat. Still a small one-bedroom flat. And
remember how big it was?
I think 33 square meters.
Above the 30.
Above the 30.
In terms of the minimum requirement for most lenders.
Yep. Yeah, so it's about 33, just over, I think, 33 or 34. And so turned it into a one bedroom. So clearly, 33 square meters. This is going to be a small one bedroom flat.
Sure.
And 6 months later, I had it revalued and it was valued at £575,000. And I rented it, I think, immediately at 1,000. Was it 1,008 or 1,009? It was either 18 or 1,900. So that to me was maximizing the value of that property. So it was a small studio flat. I could have left it as a studio flat, but it's seeing the potential in something. And again, lots of people talk about changing a one bedroom into a two bedroom and a two bedroom into whatever. And some people do it so badly that they actually devalue the property. So it's not about creating that extra bedroom. It's creating it in a way that's going to be recognized as value. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, for sure. That makes a lot of sense. You've spoken about, obviously, buying properties at auction. You've spoken about converting a studio to a one bed, also a HMO. What is your current strategy at the moment?
Oh, flipping.
Because you've been speaking about your tenants, about renting that one, but so at the moment, are you more in flipping over holding? And why is that the case?
I'm definitely flipping over holding because so it's all to do with the new legislation that I think is going to get royal assent. So where are we today? We are Monday in 2 days' time. I reckon it's going to get royal assent, or this week anyway.
Now, what does that mean?
So it means that the king is going to sign and it will become law. And then we'll just have to wait and see when the various bits in the act are going to be implemented. So, you know, the renters' rights, so it's still the bill, but it will become the act once it gets royal assent. I think it's a good piece of legislation in the main, but also I think it just, it's going to cause a number of problems.
So for those that are not familiar with what the renters' rights is, if we give like sort of some top level, you know, I know it's
okay.
Very comprehensive to kind of go through it apart. And people, if people want to find out about it in more detail, they can read the book that's called...
Be Prepared, Renters' Rights and Residential Landlords in England. However, having said, that was talking about the bill when it first came out. So that book was, I published it on the 10th of January, 25. Mm-hmm. And a couple of things have changed in the meantime. So it's not completely up to date. I probably wouldn't say go read the book. If you've got the book, all well and good. If you haven't got the book, I think probably just leave it be. The various governments, so not just the Labour government, but the Conservative government before the Labour government, decided that tenants were being unfairly treated by landlords. Mm-hmm. Now, I think there are definitely some landlords who were not treating their tenants very nicely. But in the main, I think most landlords were actually being fairly decent. Mm. In any event, they decided that they were going to actually change the way that the private rented sector operates. So under the Conservatives, we had the Renters Reform Bill, mm-hmm. But that came to nothing. And then we had an election and Labour were voted in and Labour made a few tweaks and their bill was called the Renters' Rights Bill. And what it does, so top level, anyone who's been a landlord, it would know about Section 21 evictions. So if you wanted your property back, you didn't have to give any reason. You just had to give the tenant 2 months' notice. And that should have been that, as long as like you could tick various boxes. That is going. So landlords will now no longer be able to issue Section 21 notices to get tenants to leave their properties.
Question for you on that. Is that going to be for all existing tenancies or tenancies signed post the bill? Or we don't know yet.
So... I know.
Oh, you know.
I know.
Oh, you know. Oh, you know. Then tell us because you know.
Okay. So what's going to happen is when the Renters' Rights Act comes into effect and we get the implementation date. So part one, chapter one, that area of the bill, as soon as that is implemented, boom, gone. No more Section 21s. Now, there is one exception. So if somebody has already issued a valid Section 21 notice, then that will carry on mm-hmm. as long as they if they need to enforce through the courts, yeah. they do so within 3 months of the implementation.
So very similar to when they invoke Article 4. If you've already got your application in for example, your yes. HMO conversion yep. from C3 to C4.
Yep.
It will be effectively like, look, we stamped it ahead of the date. So as long as you complete in X amount of time,
precisely,
you're good to
go. Yeah. So for those kind of applications, the tenancies will still be called assured shorthold tenancies. Mm. But other than those, every other tenancy is going to move from wherever they were to becoming assured tenancies. So assured tenancies are that they will roll, you know, from 1 month to the next. So they're going to be on a rolling monthly basis. And tenants will be able to give 2 months' notice to the landlord if they want to leave. So a tenant can move in on the 1st of January, let's say, and they can give you notice on the 1st of January to say that they want to leave at the end of February. So that's one of the big things that is coming in with this.
Particularly for people who are doing like serviced accommodation as well.
Precisely.
If you're doing serviced accommodation and before you were targeting, you know, ideally you want long lets because yep. people are paying you by the day rate, £100, yep. £200 a night. Now I can just, well, if I know I need somewhere for 2 months, I sign a tenancy,
yep.
give my notice the first day I move in, and now I've got great price, 2 months, landlord responsible for all of the fees, the admins, the pre-clean, etc.
Exactly, exactly. So there's all of that. Mm. And then people are not happy about that. Then there are also the eviction grounds. So eviction grounds, you know, we've got the ones that we used to have. The main changes, as I see them, are that, you know, for rent arrears, so serious rent arrears, it used to be like 2 months if somebody owed 2 months rent. You'd give them 2 months notice and then, you know, you could get them out under a mandatory ground, meaning that as long as, like, you ticked all the boxes, the court had to give you possession. So that is changing from 2 months to 3 months. And the notice period is going up from 2 weeks to 4 weeks. Now, so that means effectively you've got 3 months arrears, you've got 1 month notice. That's 4 months really where you might not be getting any rent.
So if you're looking at, I think they said the average London rental price at the moment is at around 1700-1800. You're looking at close to, by the time you incorporate the court fees, close to £8,000.
Yep.
Before you've even had a conversation.
Yep, exactly. And then the thing is, now, if any of the arrears is due to the housing element of universal credit, then you can't, you have to discount that. So there has to be 3 months, there will have to be 3 months arrears when you issue the notice and 3 months arrears when you go to court. So say they the tenant's expecting universal credit for £1,000, your 3 months cannot actually, you know, you can't say you've got 3 months because you're looking at 3 months where you've not been paid. Then you'll say, okay, they're expecting £1,000 from UC. So that means you're not actually owed 3 months rent.
That sounds like a mouthful because really a lot of the time, don't get me wrong, sometimes tenants can be in a really unfortunate circumstances where councils are really unorganised.
Yep.
But also likewise, there's circumstances where people just can't be bothered to go into the office to tick the boxes they need to do to get what they're actually owed.
Entitled. Exactly. Yeah. And then one thing that has really upset me with the renters' rights bill is that so a tenant can move in on the 1st of January and on the 1st of January, if the courts are open, they can apply to the tribunal and say their rent is too high from day one. So, you know, you've advertised your property for rent. You've had maybe 10 people who are interested in your property. You've chosen a particular person because for whatever reason, you think they're going to be best, you know, for your property. But they are thinking, well, actually, this property is a bit pricey, but I'm going to say whatever I need to say in order to get it. And then they get it. They go to tribunal straight away. So that I don't like, because if you're dealing with adults, adults should be able to make up their own minds. Mm. And if they've decided to go for your property, one would assume that they've decided that they're happy with the price that you're asking.
Yes, definitely a lot of moving the goalposts. I mean, I would hope as a landlord, the courts would see some common sense. However, you know, we live in a world where common sense isn't always that common. But also, when you're arguing a property price is too high, it's like, well, there should also be the common sense of, well, let's actually do real life numbers on where does this sit in terms of what's available on the market, and also look at standard conditions, sizes.
Okay, so now this is again where the issue is. Mm. So at the moment, we have a similar thing even now, but what the current legislation says is that the tribunal can only look at it if, one, the property in question is significantly higher.
So it's not just like, oh, it's my neighbour's only paying 1800 and I'm paying 1900.
Yeah, it has to be significantly higher. And also, there have to be very similar properties in the locality. So if there aren't, and it means that yours is unique.
You see what I don't like about law? Let me tell you something about law and me having to be involved. There's too much grey areas. Because what does, give us a percentage. The significant is up for determination.
I agree. I agree with you.
It should say very clearly. Because when we buy stuff at auction, the guide price has to be within 10% of the reserve. That is the law. It could be 2%, it could be 1%, but it could be most, it could be as 10. Mm-hmm. I feel like if you're going to turn around and say significant, there should be a basis of what significant means.
I agree with you.
You're going to say similar. Mm. Similar should be defined as the same way as, like, as people that buy properties, we have to say, okay, type of property, size of property, like condition of property, you know. But
yeah, I guess similar would come under that. Yeah. Significant, you're absolutely right. You know, significant to one person might be different to significant to somebody else. Mm. But yeah, so that's what we have at the moment, which is great, I think, because it allows for unique properties to be charged for accordingly. But with the new laws, no. So if you have a really unique property and you're charging what might be considered to be reasonable, your tenant can take you to court and say, well, the one next door is £200 less.
And it's also like, if there's not, like, I think a good example was, I know some guys that finished a development over in Sydenham, Southeast London. Mm. That's a really interesting place where it's within a big, the development is inside this park.
All right.
So it's like, there's a house and then a very small block of four flats where they sit alone inside a park, completely like detached, private gardens, lovely, you know, loads of like
amazing
duplex, dual heighted ceilings. But they are, for what they are, they're almost double market value. Mm. Like in terms of if a two bedroom flat in Sydenham is £2,000, these are £3,600. Mm. But the reality is there's no other property that sits in the middle of a park. So how do you benchmark a comparison of similar that it?
You see, that is the main issue. So what people are saying, people like me are saying, is that in the future, properties like that are not going to be put on the market because you don't want to go to tribunal and be told that, no, your 3,600 is unreasonable. You can only charge 2,400 or whatever it might be. So we think it's going to drive the quality of properties down and it's going to actually reduce the options for tenants. So that is not a good thing.
It is because, you know, optionality is really important. And when we look at the, you know, the mandates from governments, when they're actually looking at, okay, why are we going to put policy into place? Why are we going to, you know, make certain things part of our manifesto? A lot of it is around trying to increase the housing stock, but unfortunately, or improve the housing stock. But unfortunately, I think they're having the typical politician discussions without involving the people actually that do it on a day-to-day basis. And it would be great if people like ourselves, also the tenants as well, people on both sides of the argument, were involved in the conversation where you actually could find something that realistically works. Because nobody, I think, you know, in their right mind would dispute the fact that there is an undersupply of housing, quality housing in the UK. Mm. However, how best to deliver that? I think there is no blanket, let's make this law because it sounds good, it's going to get some votes, but actually it's going to be counterintuitive.
It's like votes. And unfortunately, I think it's the tenants who are going to be worse off. Also, advance rent. So you might have had a tenant, you know, I always do comprehensive referencing for my tenants. If they can't pass the comprehensive referencing for whatever reason, maybe they've just come from abroad or they've had some problems with their credit, then I give them the option of either providing a guarantor or paying the rent up front. You cannot now obtain rent in advance. you can only obtain 1 month's rent in advance maximum and only after the tenancy agreement has been signed by both parties. There's a whole lot of things in this new, you know, legislation that is coming out. And also rent increases. Well, so rent increases, if you want to increase your rent, you can only do it, you know, using the statutory method, which is fine. But the tenant... When the tribunal decides on the rent, if the tribunal decides that what you've asked the tenant for is reasonable, the tenant doesn't have to backdate their payment to when you asked them. It can only be from when the tribunal says, yes, it's reasonable, or it can be not for another 2 months if the tribunal believes that the tenant is going to be going to have difficulty in paying it. So there's a whole, so many changes.
And I think, look, when you look at it.
And sorry, on that point, the tribunal can also decide that your rent is too high. So you might have been charging £1,000 for 5 years. And then you say to the tenant, I'd like another £50, please. You go through the proper form for Section 13 procedure and you get to tribunal. The tribunal could say, well, actually, this is only worth 900. So there's so many things that can happen. So I think that the thinking behind the legislation is actually good, because some tenants have, you know, their rights have been abused and that's not very good. But in the main, you know, like I said, I was interviewed by the BBC a few weeks ago, which actually resulted in a death threat. So that was horrible. But what I said to them was...
There's no one likes landlords. Someone the other day told me they wish ghosts hunt me for the rest of my life.
No.
Because I took down coving in a property that we had to replace the ceilings on. And I was like, I couldn't levitate it. So, but you know.
Wow. I know. We're hated so much. Yeah. We provide such a needed service. But anyway, so as I said to them on the BBC, I said, you know, the law is actually throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Mm-hmm. You know, it's good, but it's just
idea versus execution.
It's just, yeah. I do worry. And also, local authorities are now in charge of deciding whether or not landlords are complying. And if they're not complying and the local authority decides that a landlord hasn't complied, there could be a penalty of up to £7,000. And if that happens again within 28 days, blah, 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 up to £40,000.
Do you know what's really interesting about that?
Mm.
Local authorities haven't even got on top of their own damp and mould problem. That, like, even basic just ventilating properties and dealing with airflow, they struggle with large government budgets,
yep,
with entire departments, maintenance teams. However, John and Jill, the landlords that happen to have one property by accident that they really love and try and look after, are going to be, you know, £7,000 fine, rent reviews, can't evict their own tenant, even if, you know, the property isn't financially viable to them.
Yep. Well, and the thing is, they will be doing that because they can keep that money. If you know, if whatever it costs them to enforce, they can keep. So, you know, they're motivated. They're going to be, you know, financially motivated. And then let's start on the rent repayment orders. And, you know, if the local authorities, if they were actually, I don't want to use a rude word, but if they were very capable...
No, then, you can say if they were competent.
I don't suppose we'd mind so much. Do you know, just the other day, I got a letter and it really did scare me. It was something, we want to come and have a look at your property under a particular piece of legislation. And the legislation was, they suspect that there might be a category 1 or 2 hazard. And so they have to come and have a look and this and this and that. And I thought, where is this coming from? Now, the property in question has been empty since March. It's under offer, just waiting to exchange. And so I'm thinking, well, clearly nobody's living there. So no one would have complained. So I looked at the legislation and the legislation said, if they want to come under that particular part of the legislation, a justice of peace must have signed an order. So I wrote back to them and I said, oh, can I please have a copy of what the Justice of Peace has signed? And then I get this response back saying, oh, no, we just want to come and have a look. So I said, well, if you just want to come and have a look, I don't have any issue with that, but you need to notify me under the correct piece of legislation, because this is not it. Anyway, the guy has insisted that he's right. But you see, this just goes to show they don't know what they're doing. And we're not even in the Renters' Rights Act, like, you know, period yet. And they are overstepping, overreaching. And I did say to him, I said, you know, this is ultra-virus. And he didn't even know what I was talking about.
Yeah, I mean...
That's going to be a problem.
You deal with it a lot. You deal with it at a lot of different levels, at council levels. I had one, you know, recently, if you've got a council, a housing association, it's your freeholder. He randomly wrote to me threatening... You're in service charge arrears. We're going to contact your landlord, you're in breach of your lease. And I said, you've not even sent me an invoice. You're required, like, I can't just pay it because you've randomly just said, you owe me £1,000. There needs to be a breakdown, it needs to be. But again, it is, I guess, a lot of the time dealing with people that are probably overworked and underpaid a lot of the time. And so there is that balance. But we go back to the initial question, which effectively was, what's your strategy at the moment? At the moment, like a lot of us, we've moved away from the gold standard, which was buy to let, build a portfolio, generational wealth, and actually saying, do you know what? Let me get in, let me get out, let me get paid, because I don't know what tomorrow looks like. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
Well, not only that, I'm also selling. Mm-hmm. So with my non-HMOs that are not with a company, in fact, all of my non-HMOs are now with like a company that I deal with. The ones where I had individuals, they're the ones that I'm selling, because it's just, it's worrisome.
But even the HMO company ones, like I remember this piece of law as well, and even if you've got like a guaranteed rent company on board, there's an argument between who takes the lion's share of the rent. And if you're taking over 50%, then the company who is paying you, then actually the buck still falls at you as well.
Okay, so now what you've done there is expose another thing in the Renters' Rights Act, which as it will be. Mm. So that you're talking about case law, where case law said to do with rent repayment orders, the owner doesn't have to be irresponsible if they're not taking that. That's gone. That's gone. So with the under the Renters' Rights Act, the owner will be ultimately responsible in every situation.
So the concept of guaranteed rent is kind of out the window now, because it's like, well, it's guaranteed until it's a problem, and then it's the landlord's problem.
And it's always going to be the landlord's problem. And also, if there's a company involved, so this is where it gets really interesting. So say there's a company involved and an offence has been committed. So that is where you can be fined up to £40,000. And say like you and I are directors of the company in question. The company can be fined £40,000 up to 40. You can be fined up to 40. I can be fined up to 40 if we're seen to be responsible for the company's actions. Now, companies are what? They're a piece of paper. Anything they do is being done by their directors. So ultimately, it is likely that the directors are going to be responsible. So for that one offence, the local authority can actually, it can fine, so up to £120,000 in that example.
Which again, makes no sense, because the whole concept of a company is that it is a separate entity.
Yep, yep. But they're getting rid of that.
It's the definition of cake and eat it.
Yeah. And you know, you also spoke about guaranteed rent and companies and all of those. So where in the past you might have an agreement with someone who takes on your property, and say it's a 5-year agreement, and you say at the end of 5 years, you give me back my property empty. You can't. That is no longer enforceable. You can't insist on that. Even though you might have signed an agreement to that effect, the Renters' Rights Act says you cannot insist on vacant possession. So, yeah, there's so many things. So many things. We can't go into all of them.
This is the importance of, like, just, I guess, podcasts in general, conversations, because there's so much that, you know, if something bothers you, you're going to pick up and really highlight on it, because that's going to affect you.
Yeah.
But likewise, there's going to be little areas that I'm going to look at and I'm going to say, oh, that's dangerous. And it is, like, there's so many things that are changing. Even when it comes to flipping, you look at it and I'm like,
okay.
It's still making it scary. So now they've made, I don't know if you saw that, if, for example, you have your like planning conditions and it says you're going to build in, I don't know, like old stock, like Yellowstone brick, for example, but for whatever reason, you end up building it in something else. If you breach planning now, or like, for example, you were supposed to go out by 2 meters, you went up by 2.5 meters. If you breach planning, that now actually falls under the Proceeds of Crime Act.
Okay, so with that, if you breach planning, the local authority first has to serve you with an enforcement notice. Yeah. If you then ignore that, that's when they can come to you under the Proceeds of Crime Act. Yeah,
which is
they're using that a lot now.
Yeah, I saw it. I saw there was the case for the restaurant in North London with the extractor fan. Under Proceeds of Crime, it was in the hundreds of thousands or maybe even in the millions for an extractor fan.
Well, do you know what? What they're doing as well is, some local authorities, they've known about this for a long time. So they've served their enforcement notices, but they've done nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the landlord has just carried on renting out and taking in the rents. And then when they come, they can just claim all of those rents. Yeah, I know. It's not fun being a landlord anymore.
It's not, which is why a lot of people have moved in, been manoeuvring. So many things I wanted to speak to you about, but because I think we just get excited about the stuff. Not excited, even wound up and bothered and be like, I'm going to have my little complaint, you have yours. But hopefully if you're watching this, you've got loads of information, particularly around what's coming. Because the whole idea of being an investor, being an entrepreneur, isn't just about operating in the current market, but preparing yourself and positioning yourself to operate in what's coming in the future. Now, outside of obviously being a landlord, being a mentor, creating content in the podcast space, you've now also got a new initiative where you've been running webinars, and it's something called Tenant to Owner. Why did you, I guess, for somebody who focuses on flipping properties now, why is that something you wanted to create and what is it?
Okay, so it was just my way of trying to give back.
Stay away from the death threats.
Stay away from the death threats. No, not just that. I've been thinking about it for a while. Mm-hmm. So both my children have lived abroad. Mm-hmm. So one in Canada, one in America. Mm-hmm. And each time when they were there, there were people who just embraced them, who took them in, who really, really helped them. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to my older son a few years ago when he came back from Canada, actually. I said, are you going to buy? And he said, well, Mum, I was very indignant. People in my generation can't. My generation is different to yours. And I was very surprised. I didn't know where he got that from. Anyway, I was doing webinars at the time. It was during the lockdowns. And he attended the first one and immediately came to me and said, oh, Mum, I really would like to do this. So we sat down, we worked out how he was going to do it. And within about 6 months or so, he'd bought his own place. And it made me just think about people who don't have people around them who can tell them what's what and who can actually guide them. But I didn't do anything about it. But every single tenant that I've met, I've always asked them, oh, don't you want to buy? Mm. And I'm yet to meet a tenant who says, no, I don't want to. I'm not interested. Everyone says, yes, I want to buy. So that's why I thought I'll start Tenant to Owner, because it may just be that they don't know that they can buy. Because, for instance, there's a mortgage specifically for tenants where they don't have to pay a deposit. And as long as their mortgage payments are going to be less than what they've been paying in rent, and they've been paying their rent diligently for the last 12 months, they can get a mortgage based on that. How many tenants actually know about that? Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to kind of like just have a resource where I can help tenants who really want to buy their own, because even with the Renters' Rights Bill / Act, no tenant actually is going to have that ultimate peace of mind. When I was renting, I wanted to know that my place was my own. If I wanted to paint the whole place black or purple or yellow, then I could do it without anyone saying to me, you're not allowed to do that, or you've breached this rule or that rule. And I could just do whatever I wanted in my own property. And I think so many people actually do want that. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a dream that has been stolen, unfortunately, from a whole generation of people, because they've been told they can't. And that's not true.
I think it's really interesting you say that, because particularly in the content space, I think a lot of content creators like put out the fact that, oh, this new generation don't want to own. Mm-hmm. And it's good because it gets traction, because it sounds good and you sound like you're appealing to the masses. But actually, on a one-to-one level, you're very right. Whenever I speak to tenants, like, their longer term goal would be to have their own property, not just to own it, not just as a capital appreciation, but more just for that peace of mind outside of any change in legislations, any change in anything, that this is mine, I can do what I like with it, you know. And ultimately, even as interest rates have gone up, like, you know, they're at what you're looking at, 4.5% around that amount for a residential mortgage. Mm. If you check the London rental prices versus what your mortgage would be, even a 95% mortgage, generally you're still going to find it's cheaper to own.
Precisely. And also, you know, you talk about changes in legislation. I've been hearing people saying that if a particular party comes in 3.5 years' time, they're actually going to tear up this Renters' Rights Bill stroke Act. Who knows? But, you know, for ultimate, you know, kind of like peace of mind, and like you say, also, it makes financial sense. And I, when my son was buying, I said to him, I said, buy a two-bedroom. Mm. Buy a two-bedroom place. And he did. And he's in one, and he lets out the other bedroom. So he's actually also making money. And the government is encouraging
up to
this.
£700,
is £7,500 a year.
For the year. So you can rent out a spare room because, again, housing crisis.
Yeah. It's tax-free.
Exactly.
Tax-free, £7,500. So, you know, people can also do that. They can make money. They can save. It's a no-brainer. Mm. And, yeah, so I'm really on a mission at the moment to try and get tenants to see what their options are. Because, again, you see, if you are a person who feels that you have no options, you're going to be bitter. You're going to be frustrated. But there's no need to be. It's just a question of, like, getting the knowledge. So in the property, you know, kind of like arena that we're in, people go and find out. And they know what they can do. And they start working towards what they can do. And that gives them a purpose. But if you're a tenant and you've been told, no, you'll never be able to own. Oh, no, 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 no. All the boomers have bought, you know, the properties in the country. So there's nothing left for the Gen Zs and the millennials. And you believe that, you're just frustrating yourself. So that is just my way of, you know, helping people who don't have people around them to say, actually, that's a lie. You can do it. So I'm just putting myself in that gap and saying, yes, you can. Not everyone will be able to. Mm-hmm. I completely accept that. But for most people, maybe even not for most people, but for some people, at least, they should be able to. So many mortgages, like I said, the one, no deposits. Mm-hmm. And when I speak to tenants who say they can't, you know, that they've not bought, but they want to, they often say, oh, because I don't have a deposit. But there are mortgages that are there where they don't need a deposit.
Barclays have bought back the 0% deposit mortgages. Nationwide have a 5% one.
Right.
That's good. Like, there are some options that are available out there.
So many, yeah.
There is. It's been amazing having you. And if people want to connect with you and get in touch, how can they find you?
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you for having me. So Patricia Rogan-Faber, I'm on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. I'm on Instagram. And Tenant to Owner is also on Instagram. It's only literally just started within the last few days. And it's on the internet as well. So www.tenanttoowner.co.uk. The two can be the digit two, or it can be T-O. Either one will get you there. And
amazing.
The podcast is Maximizing Property Values. And in fact, the book that I said people shouldn't buy, I've been reading the book chapter by chapter for the last few months.
Okay.
So it's on there as well. And that's completely free.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. Well, thank you very much for for coming on today. Obviously, we're going to make sure we have the links in the description. I think you're doing some really, really exciting things.
Thank you for having me.
Going to work out collectively how we can do something with Tenant to Owner to do something to give back, because it's all about providing value. If you've enjoyed today, please make sure you subscribe, like always. If you've got any questions for myself or my auntie, then let us know in the comment section. And apart from that, we'll catch you next week for another episode.